And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday, from 10 to 11 o'clock in the morning here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is how culture changes over time. And before we get to our next guest, big shout-out to Bob here in Ventura, who won the McConnell's Ice Cream giveaway for a free cone or a free cup of ice cream from McConnell's on East Main Street. Don't worry if you called in and you didn't win. We'll have another ice cream giveaway in the second part of our hour today as well. As I said, today's theme is how culture changes over time. My first guest looked at the impact of social media on business and presentations. My next guest is a master storyteller and journalist. He writes about Mexico and Mexican immigration from a unique perspective. His stories examine how culture, both Mexican and American, have changed as a result of the immigration. If you've got a feeling about Mexican immigration, if you want to call in and join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. And remember to keep that number handy because we will have another ice cream giveaway in the next 40 minutes or so. Sam Quiñones is author of two books of narrative nonfiction about Mexico and Mexican immigration, and it makes him, and this is a quote, the most original writer on Mexican and the border, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. He has an interesting past. From 1994 to 2004, he lived and worked as a freelance writer in Mexico. He visited all the major immigration sending states. He spent time with gang members, with governors, taco vendors, Los Tigres del Norte. He wrote about soap operas. He lived briefly in a drug rehabilitation clinic in Sonora, and he was hanging out with a street gang. He did the same with a colony of transvestites in Mazatlan, with merchants in Mexico City neighborhood of Tepito, and with regulated PRI congressmen known as the Bronx. He hung out with the promoters of Tijuana's opera scene, and with the makers of plaster statues of Mickey Mouse and Spider-Man in the city's Colonia Libertad area. He received the Alaysha Patterson Fellowship and Columbia University's Maria Moore Cabot Prize for writing excellence in reporting about Latin America. Welcome to the show, Sam. How are you today?
Very well. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, well, it's our pleasure to have you on board. I've been looking forward to this interview. And your latest book is titled Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. So tell me, let's just start at the beginning. Why did you write Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream?
Well, because I thought that basically I love the stories of Mexican immigration. And I love them because they're so complex. Unlike the debate that has been taking place over the last several years in this country regarding Mexican immigration, in which people are just like firmly staking out two sides and they don't move, they don't alter their views really about this issue, I found that immigrant stories were enormously complex, very fluid, and included a lot of very human qualities you could find in the same immigrant, you know, great nobility and generosity and envy and jealousy and cowardice and courage, you know, all in the same thing. It seemed like a very kind of human story to tell. I tried not to tell it as if I had great heroes because I tend to think that when you start to try to find heroes in stories, it blinds you to some of their failings and their foibles. But rather to try to tell stories about people and how they were navigating extremely difficult circumstances, how a group of people might do the same, and so the immigrant issue is just enormous. I mean, it's such a great kind of fertile territory for writing about great human stories. I think. I mean, you're talking about people who are leaving everything they know and go out into the world armed almost only with their wit, you know, and cross into another culture, cross into another place, another language without any papers, and it brings out the best and the worst of people, and that's kind of what I wanted to capture.
And I think that you did. You have some fantastic stories in the book, and again, for those people who didn't know, it's called Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. What interested me and piqued my interest to have you on the show is the impact of drug trafficking has had on immigration patterns. In particular, I'm fascinated about the Mennonite connection that you write about. So tell us that story, please.
Well, basically, when you live in Mexico, anyone will tell you, I think, who's lived down there for any length of time, people know that there are colonies of Mennonites in Mexico, the largest one being south of Ciudad Juarez, about 4 or 5 hours south of there. And they've been, the Mennonites are very Germanic. They don't intermarry with other Mexicans very often. They still speak a kind of a form of German. They're very light skinned, rosy cheeked, have names like Heinrich and Johann and so on. And they're various areas around the country. They're uniformly viewed as very pious, holy people, people who are very religious, who kind of maintain a very strong connection to the earth. They're terrific dairy farmers. They make a nationally famous cheese called queso Menonita. And you see them in different cities. I used to see them in Mexico City selling their cheese among the cars at the traffic stops and so on. You see them in Ciudad Juarez a lot and so on. And the idea is that these folks are just wonderful, kind of God-fearing folks. In the course of my writing the book, I discovered that actually there's another side to this community, particularly the one south of Juarez, and that is that a lot of the folks in that community have become drug traffickers. They have, some of it is out of desperation because a lot of Mennonite farmers face the same problems that Mexican farmers face everywhere, lack of credit, drought, bad land, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of problems that they face. So a lot of them turn to either full-time trafficking or taking a load across for, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 into the United States. They have become major traffickers, though, and the largest marijuana connection into parts of Canada are Mennonite traffickers. Now, they've also they started, I believe, by because they used to make a tractor trailer, you know, big rig trucks, mm-hmm. and the compartments and so on. They would fashion hidden compartments for the Juarez drug cartel is how they first got into it, is my understanding. And from there, they got into, you know, smuggling their own dope through, and they began to emerge. There was one family I talk about in the book that really kind of established this as the main, as a major occupation in the Mennonite area. So I went down there really to try to tell the great Narco Menonita story, you know, the Mennonite mob story. Mm-hmm. Very surreal place. People are, you know, just 20 years away from the horse and buggy. Now they drive cars in that area, but I think in the mid-80s they were still in horse and buggy, most of them. And now they're driving big trucks, and they're kind of mobbed up, some of these guys.
Now, are they mobbed up? Are they armed as well? I mean, are these gun-packing Mennonites?
But I know that they are. I mean, I didn't see it myself. Basically, what happened to me was I began asking the wrong questions of the wrong people, the very day I was going to leave, I had actually planned to leave, they begin following me. So it was this unbelievably surreal scene where, you know, I'd been living 10 years in Mexico and never, as far as I know, ever been followed by anybody. And in my life, I've never been followed, you know, in a car or anything like that. And all of a sudden, I'm being followed by these Mennonites, you know, and through the streets of, through this area, this rural kind of area, into this big town, trying my best to do my little evasive maneuvers, which function not at all because I'm easily spotted, and they kind of have, there are many of them, and they're switching cars. They switched cars three times on me, you know.
Wow.
And finally, I went to the police department, and the best thing I did was call a colleague in Mexico City. She spoke with the Mexican government, the president's international press secretary, who got on the phone and made sure that the cops up there knew that this situation was being watched. And I was then transported to the airport in the state of Chihuahua, Chihuahua City Airport, with, you know, by cops. One of them had a, you know, AK-47 on his lap and the whole thing. I mean, it was just surreal.
And
that's how I left. And for 2 or 3 months after that, I had a fear, a terrific phobia of tall Germanic men. You know?
Very amusing story. We're talking to Sam Kunis, everybody.
When you're telling it, it was not amusing.
I bet not at the time.
Let me tell you.
I'm not trying to make light of it, Sam. Very interesting story, and I love that. We're talking to Sam Kunis, everybody, author of the book Antonio's Guns, Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Immigration. And I think the Mennonite story really does point out the juxtaposition or the complexity of the characters in Mexico. It's not just a single issue. And I wanted to come back to the main, if you will, call him the main character. Delfino Juarez is the central character in your book.
Right.
And he himself is complex and rich. So tell us a little bit about Delfino.
Well, he was a kid that I met in Mexico City. Now, people may not know, but Mexico City, much the same way the United States has relied on cheap Mexican labor to do its, you know, landscaping and maid work and all the rest and construction and so on, Mexico City is the same way. It relies on cheap Mexican labor for its maids and its construction workers. And these are kids who come from the little towns, the little villages surrounding Mexico City in the states of Oaxaca, Puebla, Hidalgo, Morelos, various states like that, Veracruz. And they are destitute, very, very hardworking kids, but they are utterly mistreated and utterly ignored and abused and exploited. And I was looking for a way to write their story. I knew that this existed, but the problem is the maids are in their houses, the houses where they work. They live there, so it's very difficult to gain entry there. And number two, the guys are working all construction, and they're kind of like gypsies. Whenever the work, they live in the work site, and when the work is done, they move to the next work site. And so getting into this world was particularly difficult for me, until one day when I was in the Alameda, the central park in Mexico, in downtown, and I on Sunday afternoon, these kids have only one day off, and that's Sunday, and they want to have as much fun as they possibly can, naturally.
Sure.
These are kids. We're talking about 15, 17-year-old kids. They're most of them are not adults. And I was swept up into this river of these kids now down by the Alameda. It turns out, as I come to find out, these are kids who, the Alameda has been turned into kind of an open-air single scene for these kids, these hillbilly kids who come to the city to work and make money. And a lot of these kids, by the way, send their money home every week, and their parents and their villages depend on it, much the same way villages in Mexico depend on dollars sent home from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to hang out with these kids. It was a very weird thing at first. I was not entirely comfortable because I'm 6 foot tall and light-skinned, and these kids were all like 5'5 and dark and were looking at me like I was some kind of Martian. But in time I got to know them, and Delfino Juarez was one of those kids. In fact, he was a kid who had kind of helped begin what at the time was a raging fad among these construction workers, which was to do break dancing. They would have these around the Alameda. There were these little dance halls that was set up. The whole Alameda was really on Sunday afternoons was set up to cater to these hillbilly kids, and they wanted cheap dancing, you know. And so they had these little dance halls set up in parking lots or in abandoned buildings. And there's good about 8 or 10 of these things when I was there, and I met him at the one that I would hang out at, and he started kind of the break dancing fad. And in time I got to know him. All the kids were breakdancing, especially all the guys. In time I got to know the kid, and very sharp, you know, very tough, had a lot of pluck to him, a lot of gumption. He was not like a wilting lily or anything like that. He was a kid who would look you straight in the eye, which was not common among those kids. They were very kind of intimidated by me, particularly at first, because I was just tall and white, and they didn't know who I was.
Sure.
And then over time, so I wrote the story about, you know, Mexico's cheap labor force, which is a bunch of kids who no one pays any attention to, coming from the surrounding states to help Mexico City function. And then as time went on, I kept in touch with them over the years, and he decided that he couldn't continue on as a construction worker anymore in Mexico City because he had a wife and a kid, and that was leading absolutely nowhere for him. And so he came illegally to the United States, crossed the desert in Arizona. Another story that I tell in the book about how they did that, and one woman dies, it's kind of like becomes almost a death march for the people who survive, and he ends up as a flooring installer in Los Angeles.
Wow,
which is a terrific job if you are an immigrant, because what it did, and it really was helpful for him, it got him out of the immigrant enclave. So often, immigrants come, they land someplace, everyone around them is from the same area, from Mexico or something like that, speaking Spanish, eating the same food. They don't see any of America, even though they are kind of essential to the economy in many, many respects. They're not part of the country in a way. They go, they'll have strange ideas about the country because they'll go from their home to a factory job, say, and then back home, all around them will be people like them, and they won't have seen much of the rest of the United States. But installing flooring is a really different job. You are all over the place. You go to place at people's homes in, you know, San Diego, in Beverly Hills, in Lancaster. You're seeing part of the United States, and you are also forced to learn English or speak English. In his case, very bright kid. He learned English really quickly. I was having an English conversations with him, you know, truncated, kind of rudimentary English conversations. But
he was communicating.
Nevertheless,
yeah.
Within about a year.
Wow.
You know? And so it was this transformation. What happened then in his case was fascinating, I thought, because his village was the only village I personally had ever seen where no one had gone to the United States. Everyone had gone to be construction workers in Mexico City. It was a small little farming village on a mountain, very, very poor, but no one had ever figured out how to get to the United States. He and his brother, actually, eventually, they send money home, and they begin building houses, two houses. They become the largest employers in the town. They become the largest, I guess you might call them, foreign investors in this little village. And with that, you know, it ignites a whole immigration out of Mexico into the United States.
Wow.
People would often ask me, do you think people, corporations or whatever, come down to Mexico and put ads, you know, come up to the United States and work? And I say, no, they don't need to do that. All you need is one guy to show that he can do better than Mexico is allowing him to do by going to the United States. And for that village, Delfino Juarez was the guy. And he sent all this money home, built this big two-story house with big, enormous windows. And within a year, 80 or 100 guys from the village were in the United States.
Amazing. We're talking to Sam Quiñones, everybody, author of the book Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Immigration. Sam, we've only got about a minute left, but I'm going to ask you, what did you get out of writing this book?
I guess, great love for storytelling and for Mexico and for the complexity of the immigration issue, which I don't think reduces very easily to a couple of, you know, screaming 24-hour news stations.
Mm.
I guess I felt kind of honored in a sense to have found a topic that allowed me to write stories that really could be novels, but yet were you know, nonfiction. And all of that, I mean, I love what I was able to do, and I love the ability that being allowed to do it, I guess. And I'll be always kind of honored and awed by that.
Well, it is a great book. Sam Quiñones, everybody. He's the author of the book Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Immigration. If you are interested in Mexican immigration, if you have an opinion one side or the other on this, you need to pick up the book, because this is an eye-opening expose told through true life stories, and it reads just like fiction, Sam, just like you said. Thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
Now.